Greetings, this is Cindy Kennedy, and I'd like to invite you to subscribe to the podcast series at www.livingwithlyme.us. This will keep you up to date on all our new releases. Living with Lyme podcast guests may be discussing very controversial topics. The information contained in these podcasts are from the guests' personal experiences and are their own opinions. These podcasts are intended for information. The opinions expressed are solely the guest's own. Please discuss treatment options with your personal healthcare providers before changing or adding treatments. Enjoy the podcast.
Living with Lyme is brought to you in part by Dr. Inspired Formulations, a supplement company offering products such as liposomal artemisinin, liposomal oregano oil, and mimosa pudica. Patients can purchase without a prescription, and practitioners can open a wholesale account and carry the products in their office. To learn more, visit drinspiredformulations.com. That's drinspiredformulations.com. We'd also like to thank Hopkinton Drug. Many people have unique healthcare needs that mass-produced pharmaceutical medications just can't meet. That's why more people turn to Hopkinton Drug, a locally based compounding and wellness pharmacy. Whether it's Lyme disease, mold illness, thyroid, hormone replacement therapy, pediatrics, or dermatology, Hopkinton Drug's specially trained and licensed pharmacists can create customized compounded medications to meet your specific needs. Shipping is available nationwide. Go to rxandhealth.com. That's rxandhealth.com. Or call 800-439-4441. Hopkinton Drug, compounds with care.
Hey, everybody. This is Cindy Kennedy, and you are listening to another episode of Living with Lyme. I'm really excited and encouraged by our guest coming up today. Her name is Dr. Lauren Tessier, and she is from Vermont. She is a mold expert, and we are learning more and more about environmental as well as our food sources that have mold in it and how it can make us pretty sick. She's a licensed naturopath, and she is the vice president of ICEAI. She'll tell us what that means. And she is also, she wrote the ebook, which is really exciting. It's Mold Prevention 101. So she's going to talk to us. She's an incredible speaker, and she's been all around the nation. And so we're really excited to have her today. Hi, Dr. Lauren. How are you today?
Hi. I'm great. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here today. Probably just as excited as you are.
Oh, my God. Well, you are, you know, you're an expert in this field, and you're very, very young, so we're going to have you around a long, long time. And until people see this in video, she has a little poster behind her, and it is eliminating whining and complaining and frowning, and you can only give hugs and what was the other part of it?
Warm fuzzies.
Oh, warm fuzzies. We love that. I mean, really, it's so important because it's difficult. So, you know, let's get right into it.
Sure.
How does mold and why does mold affect our energy level?
Of course, that's a good question. You're going to come out swinging. So, with regards to energy level, we have to step back and really consider how it comes about or how it can be impacted. You know, energy level isn't just a function of sleep, right? And I'm sure everyone who's listening is nodding their head right now. They're like, yeah, fatigue is so just deep and profound into the core. And as a result of that, or potentially, you know, we're looking at lots of different things that can cause fatigue. So when I think about fatigue and I dialogue with fatigue with my clients, we're thinking about decreased oxygenation of your tissues. So if you can't carry oxygen well, you're not going to get oxygen to where it needs to be. You're not going to be able to get your energy going. There's issues with mitochondria functioning, our little powerhouses of their cell. If they're damaged or they're not being fully supported, we're going to have energy problems there. If we're having issues nutritionally with our macronutrients, our proteins, our carbs, our fats, and our micronutrients, our vitamins and trace minerals, that's going to be another source of fatigue. And then, of course, we have neurotransmitter imbalance, you know, so your serotonin and your dopamine, if those are out of whack, you're going to have issues with fatigue. And then, of course, to, you know, further complicate things, issues with, other hormones and neurotransmitters like histamine. So histamine is a hormone and it acts as a neurotransmitter. And we know that histamine can cause a good amount of fatigue because it has that ability to cross that blood-brain barrier. And so anything else that's in the body that's a result of inflammation that can cross that blood-brain barrier can result in a lot of different fatigue like symptoms.
And where does mold play into this? Is it the one thing that gets into our system and we lose our ability to oxygenate our tissue as well? It kind of impacts the mitochondrial, function, as well as does it play a role in our absorption of nutrients?
Yeah, all of the above. All of the above. I don't even have to be here. You know it all. There you go, Cindy.
Check. Well, I'm asking the questions. You know, it's a good thing to know. So it really impacts us on multiple levels.
Multiple levels. And, you know, I'm a big research nerd. In fact, this morning before we hopped on the call together, I was putting together a article that I'm writing that'll probably be out in the beginning of next year that'll be about endocrine disruption and how mycotoxins are wreaking havoc on our hormonal system. But anyway, so I'm a big research nerd, so everything that I'm saying is not speculation. It's really just coming out of deep, long research dives. So when you step back and, you know, you think about fatigue, to start off, we know that people with chronic fatigue syndromes, about 30% of these folks have been reported to have mycotoxins found in their urine. And that's pretty phenomenal. That's just about one third of these people. And then further, people with chronic fatigue syndrome, they'll experience something called post-exertional malaise. So after exercise and then malaise, that like tired feeling. So about 40% of people will get post-exertional malaise induced from mold exposure.
Wow. You know, it's funny because when I was really finally finding someone that helped me with my Lyme diagnosis, I had said to him, this is the last straw. I can't get through a yoga class. Well, right. I can make it through it, but after I'm crawling. And right. He said, well, yoga's really hard. I'm like, well, no. He's never taken a vinyasa flow class where it's just kind of gentle stretching and whatnot. But I understand that. I understand that and know what people have gone through with that.
And it's just so cruddy to hear you say that. Well, yoga's hard. It's like, well, yeah, but then I have clients who are coming in and it's, well, that's part of aging.
Oh, I don't like that. I don't like that answer.
To hear that at the age of like, you know, 40. Late 30s, 40s, 50s, even 60. I have some vibrant 65-year-olds who have come in with severe brain fog, severe fatigue, almost like a pre-Alzheimer's diagnosis. We manage to figure out what the issue is in their home. We get them out of mold exposure. We go through a few different treatments, and they're just back to it, sharp as ever, you know. And it's not to say that there isn't some Alzheimer's disease that isn't due to mold, or, you know, I'm not making that claim, but there's aging doesn't have to be have to look like that. Yeah, exactly.
Difficult. Yeah, you don't want it to be difficult. You know, everybody says, oh, don't you want to live to the ripe old age of, you know, 100? Well, not if I'm not functioning. And we, right. You know, as a family discussion, we were trying to just decide on an individual basis, would it be better for your body to start not functioning well and your mind be intact, or right. the opposite? And, yeah. Yeah, I don't think anybody really ever decided which way would be better.
No,
But I don't want to know that my mind is not functioning.
Right.
So yeah, that's difficult. So, you know, when it comes to this huge problem, what do we tell people? Do we tell people that they need to be aware of these symptoms, that it possibly can be associated. And you know, one of the things that I do want to mention are people with chronic sinusitis. You see that a lot?
Oh yeah, absolutely. People with chronic sinusitis, especially if it's been non-responsive to antibiotics, you wouldn't believe the amount of people who come into my office and they have been to HEENTs over and over. They've been to their primary care physician. They come in, they're on Benadryl, fluticasone. They're going through like numerous antibiotics a year for non-responsive chronic sinusitis. And it's like, has anyone talk to you about maybe using a nasal antifungal? Has anyone done an MRI and looked for what we call fungal balls? That's actually what they call them on MRI. They will find small fungal balls, which I love. I love the name of them. But fungal sinusitis is definitely something that pops up for people, but that's not, you know, it's not just fungal sinusitis that is a symptom for people. You know, there's so many different symptoms that'll pop up for people depending on the flavor of mold illness that they have. And to wrap everyone's head around what I mean by flavor of mold illness, there's four major types that I refer to. There's a couple of like ones that hang out in the periphery that are kind of harder to nail down. But, you know, in the evidence, we see that there is fungal infections, and then, of course, there's fungal allergies. That goes without saying. That's like, check, yep, got it, allopathic world agrees. The other two that are problematic for people that is more controversial in the Western medicine allopathic realm is mycotoxicosis and SIRS. Mycotoxicosis meaning toxic overload burden due to the toxins from molds. So mycotoxins, myco meaning fungi, toxin. So mycotoxicosis. And then with SIRS, we have that chronic inflammatory response syndrome where folks kind of will have this starting trigger. I call it the gasoline that gets poured on the fire to start it. And then the fire burns and burns and burns. The gasoline burns off, but then the fire keeps going. So with SIRS, in that picture, that gasoline could be a biotoxin like mycotoxins. It could be some of the toxins put off from bacteria like LPS, lipopolysaccharides, or, you know, the die off from Lyme, you name it. So what happens is there's an initial there's an initial kind of toxic storm that starts all this inflammation in the body. And sure, the body might be able to pass it and clear it, but there's something wrong with this signal where the body just keeps throwing out that inflammation. So that's that picture of chronic inflammatory response syndrome. Long set of words for can't turn off the inflammation. So of those four, the allergy, the infection, the mycotoxins, and SIRS, they all kind of have their own different presentation of symptoms and what to look for, but some of them will overlap, you know? So when you're thinking of allergy, you think of respiratory stuff. You think of red eyes, dry eyes, maybe some sinus pressure, cough, shortness of breath, that picture, typical triad. But then you go and you take a peek in SIRS and we have all of that. And then plus loads of other things. So the typical symptoms that I see hands down in every case, and if I could have a nickel for every time I've seen it, it's fatigue and brain fog. Yeah. Especially fatigue and brain fog with funky periosteity. And what I mean by that is people will say, I go into work on Monday, by like 3 hours in, I can't focus. I have a headache. I'm forgetful. I go home at the end of the day. I like have to power through the work week. And then Sunday, after I've been on the weekend for a couple of days, I feel back to myself and I feel great again. And then I go into work and I get sick, but people just think it's like the work or the stress of the work. And there's that periosteity that we see with mold exposure that is really profound symptom in my clients. So when I see that pop up with brain fog and fatigue, I know that we're likely dealing with something in the environment for people. And then it's up to me to figure out, is it, you know, infection, colonization, is it allergy, is it the toxicosis issue, or is it SIRS?
So how do you figure that out? Because people are like, oh my God, I've had like a urine test. Did they figure that out? I mean, does everybody get a nasal swab, mycotoxin urine, a visual field test? I mean, what's your protocol?
Yeah. So I hate protocols. I'll be the first person to tell you that there is no room for dogmatism in medicine. And if someone tells you that they have a protocol, run for the hill. Everyone is different and there's no absolutes in this world. And so to really double down and push on a protocol, I understand people's want and drive to do it, but understand that there has to be flexibility in it. And you know, that's just the reality of it. So when working with clients, now I have to be careful not to say the word protocol now that I put my foot in my mouth. I don't have,
you know what, tell me what you like. I like to do this. Half the time I do that.
Mm-hmm. So I have this little kind of like decision tree in my head, and different people kind of come in different spots along that decision tree. So maybe someone who's worked with a Lyme doctor for, you know, years before, and they've been gluten-free and dairy-free and all that, and they've done it all. Then they kind of fast track into me. So a lot of it, usually, let's just assume everyone's kind of done that base work. Cause honestly, most of my clients are familiar with, you know, the whole alternative holistic realm. They've seen like 5, 10, 15 practitioners. So they've gone through it already, you know? So usually the first thing that I do with people, is do an assessment of urine mycotoxins. And the reason why is my goal is to be very financially responsible and prudent with my clients. So what I have kind of reasoned out is if we go through and we do a urine mycotoxin test and we see if you're elevated or not elevated, and we compare that with potential exposures, whether that's at work or that's at home, and we work on that basic level first, a lot of people get better, especially if they really adhere and they really avoid. Probably like 50% of my clients get better. So it's after that initial kind of, you know, low hanging fruit, I call it, we push that out of the way. And then we go on to the next thing. The next thing would potentially be working with SIRS and chronic inflammatory response syndrome. Are you still sick even though we've completely detoxed you now and you're out of exposure? Okay, let's work on addressing your inflammation. And then we kind of go from there. Now, with regards to the urine mycotoxin test, so people will be like, well, you mentioned mycotoxins and you mentioned SIRS. What about allergy or infection or colonization? I consider infection and colonization kind of in the first pass with mycotoxins. Mycotoxins have to come from somewhere. They can come from your environment or they can come from your internal environment. So you look outside and inside when you're dealing with those mycotoxins. So if someone really clearly has a very toxic environment, we've tested, they have mold growth in their home, well, guess what? We're going to look there first. But someone who has a high mycotoxin burden and their home is like tested clean, we've had people in, we've gone through, we're going to start to consider how they might be inoculated inside, which really sets me apart from other physicians who are doing a lot of mold work. There's some folks out there that say, when you see a urine mycotoxin level, you put them on antifungals. And I can't get with that. I think that there's a time and place for antifungals. They can be really rough on the liver, some of them. And you need to use them carefully. You know, we put hundreds of thousands of tons, and that is once again cited by research, because I'm a nerd about that, hundreds of thousands of tons of azoles every year on our crops. azoles are an antifungal. And these agricultural azoles are totally related to the medical azoles, to the point that the literature shows that people who are azole naive, meaning that they haven't actually taken the antifungal, who are farmhands, have resistance to medical azoles. So they're exposed in the field to azoles, they develop a fungal infection, and then when we try to treat them in a medical setting, they're resistant. So I don't see the good it does for me to just reflexively give someone antifungals when I see an elevated urine mycotoxin test. A, I don't know if it's going to make a difference. And B, I don't know who I'm taking that life-saving medication away from in the years to come because of resistance. So I'm a huge believer in antifungal stewardship and being very cautious and very using logic and reason, judicious. Yes, yes, very judicious in my use.
So if you're not using a pharmacologic treatment, what do you find has been the most helpful to you? Is it combination therapy of herbal, single herbal? I mean, are you using, if you find that they've got this sinusitis, are you using some type of a herbal nasal cleansing kind of thing? I mean, are
sure.
you using, like I've seen recently that, you know, people use colloidal silver for sinuses. What do you like?
Yeah. So before you can really put someone on an anti-anything, right, you need to think about where the bug is. Is it in the nose? Is it in the gut? Is it in the vagina? Like where is the fungus that's causing all the issues? And depending on that, then we go a step further and we consider what the best treatment delivery is. You know, if I can get a positive culture, if I can actually get someone to cough up something out of their lungs and ship it off and get it cultured, I would love to run a culture and sensitivity on that. So I can see if there's any antifungals that could be of use if we need to go there. And then we can confirm the issue and the location. So there are natural alternatives to everything. You know, a lot of our antifungal allies in the plant world are, you know, oregano, thyme, tea tree oil topically, garlic, you know, the list goes on and on. But then we have some really cool herbs that go in and modify the fungus's ability to achieve resistance to some of these drugs when we pair it. So I believe there's some research out there that pairs green tea extract with fluconazole to decrease resistance. And do I use that sometimes? Sure. Are there other times where I will use something like biocidin? Absolutely. You know, for sometimes if we do have a nasal issue for people, it's not uncommon for me to try to do some type of, you know, neti pot nasal biocidin rinse followed by some probiotics and maybe even with a nasal restore or something like that. So the goal isn't to kind of go in and burn the fields. You know, the goal is to kind of go in, maybe weed the fields a little, but then also replant and re-inoculate. So anywhere that you're going in and kind of clearing out fungi and all that kind of stuff, you need to make sure that you're repopulating with good and beneficial bacteria to kind of choke out that niche so that fungus can't get a hold there anymore. In addition, when you're working with fungi, you really need to make sure, just like Lyme, that you're using biofilm busters. If you're not using biofilm busters, like you're essentially handing over resistance to those bugs.
So what are your thoughts on biofilm busters? Like what are you finding? Because there's several, you know, in that category.
Oh, there's so many.
Yeah, what do you like? Do you like the Like, I'm trying to think, is grapeseed oil, or, you know, what are you finding that's helpful to you?
ALA is a good one. There's a combo product out there that has ALA, black cumin, and bismuth. That's really, really phenomenal for folks. That was developed by one of my mentors, Dr. Paul Anderson. He's absolutely phenomenal. And if people don't follow his work, they really should.
What's his name? I got to write it down.
Paul Anderson. Yep, Paul Dr. Anderson. Paul Anderson. In fact, he's having a oncology conference this weekend in Seattle called the AAM. P, M as in Mary, P as in P as in Paul. He also co-authored the book Outside the Box Cancer Therapies. Paul's absolutely amazing, and he's great. So he formulated one of those biofilm products that I like using. And of course, you know, it's not just the ALA, it's not just the black cumin seed, NAC is a huge biofilm buster. A lot of our digestive enzymes, if taken on an empty stomach, could theoretically be used as biofilm busters. Serpeptidase is another one. I mean, the list goes on and on. But you just want to make sure that you're arming and equipping people with
You can't do just part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, and while we're at it, having people on a binder, if you're going to kill, you need to do a binder of some sort. And there's, once again, so many good binders out there. I used to be the one and done, cholestyramine is the best. And you can't. And, you know, when you know better, you do better. And the whole cholestyramine, 4 grams, 4 times a day. If you want to make really sensitive people sick, sure, do it, you know, but I can't do that. I am so cautious now, even before putting people on binders, because there are binders that knock people for a loop. Even just beyond the GI upset of cholestyramine, you know, I've seen charcoal cause liver pain and liver discomfort, kind of like a liver stagnation. You know, it's really dependent on the individual person. So while you're doing some type of kill protocol, you really need to make sure that you have those binders on hand, kind of staggered away from the time that you're doing those deliveries.
How long do people need to be treated for?
Depends on what they have, and it depends on how severe, you know.
Yeah, because how would you know that your area that you're treating is actually resolved? I mean, you could do testing again, but again, you know, a mycotoxin test is $300, and if someone you know, doesn't want to do that again, you know, it's hard to say, because sometimes you do treatment on a certain issue and they're great, and then boom, they're not great, and then you wonder, was it, you know, did we not, you know, eliminate enough?
I see it like a relay race. I, with these medications, am doing, and I'm not a good runner, so let's just like get that out of everyone's mind right now. I see it as a relay race where I'm starting off with people and we are, you know, handing the antifungal the baton, not me. We're handing the antifungal, whatever it may be, the baton to do the first lap of the race. And then after that, we are hoping that we have recovered the person well enough that that trade-off will be their own microbiota stepping up to help fight that, their own immune system to stepping up to help, you know, carry that next leg of the race. And, you know, every now and then you have to double back. There are some people, when you take them off a kill protocol, they might backslide a little bit. And there's something to be said about treating for long enough that sometimes you don't know until you take someone off of something. Or sometimes it is long enough, but their immune system just isn't kind of up to the task just quite yet. And it's not just the antifungal. You know, I see that with antivirals too for people. I do a lot of work around the human herpes virus families of viruses. So your cytomegalovirus, your Epstein-Barr virus, HSV-1, HSV-2, the list goes on and on. And I usually start people on acyclovir or a valacyclovir if they can handle it. Some sensitive folks, we can't handle it. And getting them on a different type of antiviral product, like an herb or a nutraceutical, sometimes are better tolerated. But you never really know who those people are going to be. I am so surprised where I have some of my most sensitive folks. I put them on an herb, they're done. They're absolutely done for. I put them on a pharmaceutical and they do great. So there's something to also take into consideration about the full profile of the herb. There are certain herbs that can be really, really rough on the liver. And then you look at their prescription counterparts. So, you know, a drug that does something similar. And it sometimes in those cases, it's better tolerated. So herbs aren't always like the best thing to do.
We'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsors. Botanical medicines are an important part of the Integrative Lyme Disease Program. Biocidin from Biobotanical Research is a professional strength broad-based program that has been extensively researched for effectiveness as nutritional support in Lyme and co-infections. Ask your practitioner about Biocidin LSF and visit biocidin.com. Master Supplements specializes in probiotic enzymes and fiber that support digestion. Their products provide results that you can feel working within 60 days or a money-back guarantee. Their staff is available to help you decide which products and programs are right for you. Visit master-supplements.com or call 800-926-2961 for more info.
Let's talk a little bit about your, you know, food sources and how people can kind of inoculate their gut from food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's absolutely possible. You know, it's got to get in there somewhere, you know, and the reality is it's happening through something that's entering your mouth. Fungi are a huge part of our biofilm in our gut. They're there. You know, we have a good amount of fungi in the biofilm in our teeth and the plaque in our teeth. And so whether that inoculation of the gut is coming from food, it's coming from maybe the colonization in our mouth or in our sinuses, you know, it's coming from somewhere upstream. It's like a river that's flowing downstream. So and if it's a damp, dark, loving mold that has a certain level of forgiveness towards pH, meaning it can kind of make it through the stomach and then make it through that high pH of the small intestine, you know, it can theoretically get a foothold really anywhere in the gut. And I think everyone gets really excited, or maybe used to, because things come and go in medicine. Used to get really excited about SIBO, 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 SIBO. And, you know, every time I tried treating SIBO, I just had people who were, you know, not really into it or really didn't change anything. And then, of course, we look into now SIFO, the small intestinal fungal overgrowth, and lo and behold, you know, that's the key for some people.
That's amazing. That's amazing. You know, recently I've learned a lot more about coffee beans, mm-hmm. and having a lot of possibility to cause mold issues. Mm-hmm. And so looking, it's very hard to find these companies that actually do some testing. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I have no attachment to any company, but the two that I understand that do most testing is Bulletproof and Purity. Do you know any other companies that?
There's a great company that Mary Ackerley likes because their coffee actually helps stimulate BDNF, which is a nerve growth stimulating component, and they put it in their coffee. I think it's like BDNF coffee. I believe they might do mycotoxin tests, but you know, it's really mycotoxins in food. And for people who are, you know, like she keeps saying mycotoxins, what the heck are these things? So to rewind, and we probably should have said it back a half an hour ago.
Hopefully, people have stayed on.
Probably, you know? They're still watching.
We apologize.
Yeah, sorry, guys.
It's kind of like when I used to sit around the table with any of my coworkers, like at a party, and my husband was there, and we would get into, you know, any type of medical talk and lingo, and he'd be sitting there and he didn't have a clue. You know? Dot, 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 dot. Okay, so mycotoxins.
So mycotoxins are what we call metabolites of molds. And so they're these super teeny, 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 like, and if any nerds out there, 500 to 1500 Daltons, small, to the point that they are 0.01 to 0.03 microns, meaning that they'll pass right through a HEPA filter. So, you know, they're hard to catch. They're really hard to degrade. So they really also, because they're so small and they are what we call ionophoric, so they have a fat-loving side and a water-loving side. And because of that, if everyone remembers back to basic chemistry, like dissolves like, they can pass into and out of cells easily because they can kind of do the water thing and then they can do the fat thing. So because of that, and because they're so small, they hide out really well in our bodies. They bioaccumulate really well. And from what we see, they bioaccumulate a lot with regards to fatty tissue. So nervous system, you know, any type of extra cushion that we might have. So they're really hard to get rid of too, because mycotoxins have this defense system where they degrade some of our glutathione. So they use up our glutathione, which is a huge thing that we use for detox. But then they also go and they mess with the enzymes that allow us to have healthy amounts of glutathione. And they also mess with enzymes that kind of control glutathione from even a step back from across the room. So something like NRF2, that's a little bit more upstream. So they have this beautiful way of just kind of getting in there and then being like, you can't deal with me. You know, so
wow, this is kind of like some friends that I have.
So they're really hard to get rid of, and to the point that, you know, mycotoxins really only started to be paid attention to in the 1960s, and mostly the research back then, and even still now, there's tons of research on aflatoxin B1, which is a very potent mycotoxin and also has the ability to cause carcinoma. So it also has the ability to cause like cancer in the liver. And so the bulk of the research in the beginning was really on aflatoxin because they saw the risk. And so as more and more research has come about, we actually see it in the animal sector. So in our agricultural industry and our zoological industry, because guess what? That's where the money is. Annually, about $932 million are lost in the agricultural sector because of mold and mycotoxin damage. And so, you know, if we have the motivator of a financial concern, of course, that's where all the research is going to be. Not for, you know, Jen, who is at home and, you know, has severe mastocytosis and can't get out of bed and is severely ill. Like, no one's going to do the research on that because Jen isn't $932 million. So the bulk of the research is really in that agricultural finance sector. And so with mycotoxins, there's a good amount of animal research. And we have to remember, these are also the animals that we do all our initial drug studies on.
You know, so, it's interesting because a lot of people pay a lot of attention to veterinary research as it relates. Yeah, but who would think, you know, we would look. And this is one of the difficult tasks as a provider is to provide the, you know, undisputable research based on what you're doing and what you're giving to people, especially when you're doing it in a non-conventional way, because people want to know. People, you know, I had somebody once ask me, where's all the research from Dr. Buhner? And I'm like, well, if you open up his book, you're going to find more research. I can't quote it. I'm the worst quoter of research and statistics. Like, I was going to tease you a little bit about your recent number that you quoted, because I was going to say, yeah, I think at the end it said 0.5, but I'm not. I read that.
62 cents.
In 62 cents. I know. Can you get GI fungal as well as vaginal fungal problems from the environment? Is that like maybe your weakest link, that things have gotten through to your tissue, because you're saying they're water, they're fat, they can, you know, provide both of those?
Can you rephrase that question?
Yeah, I'm just wondering if you're testing positive for your mycotoxins in your urine.
Yep.
And you have a lot of environmental, you know, you're thinking the environment is the problem.
Yep.
Can you have GI fungal from that, from the environment, as well as vulvovaginitis?
You know? For sure.
Yeah. So people don't put that together.
Yeah. So something, and if people want to go digging, on all my social media, most of my posts are backed by a research piece. And on my Instagram in particular, it's Life After Mold. There is a picture of a washing machine. So if you see that one, pull it up. And there's a piece of research where there's resistant candida growing in washing machines.
Oh yeah. Especially front loaders, right?
Oh yeah. So front loaders, without a doubt. Front loaders, don't own them, please. Sorry.
I know. I have one. Oof.
But the kicker here is the fact that, you know, let's say a woman, Candida parasopolis. Now I'm remembering specifically.
Wow. That's a mouthful.
Yeah. And I might be pronouncing it correctly. Let's say a woman has tested positive with a yeast infection of that particular species. They, you know, wash their underwear with the rest of their clothing in the washing machine, and then they go back, and then, you know how clothes get every week, every couple of weeks, the same thing pops up. I mean, if your immune system is suppressed enough and your microbiota is suppressed enough, you could theoretically be re-inoculating yourself if we know that it grows in a washing machine. Like, of course it's going to, you know, get translated onto clothes. So, yes, I do see environmental issues, you know, can take hold in the gut. And theoretically could take hold in vaginal and other areas of the body too, for sure.
It's unfortunate because we have all of these orifices as well as, you know, statistically, this stuff just came out about how us as a human are a small segment of what our total microbiome consists of. So our microbiome genetics are what, four times what we are?
It's insane. Yeah. It's insane. And you know what? I'm just going to take this. I'm having so much fun in this interview, by the way, to take it a little bit more esoteric. So not only are we mostly bacteria DNA, but our bodies and the nature of atoms and the way things are set up, we're mostly space. We are mostly empty space from a chemical perspective. And so, you know,
I don't understand that. Explain what you mean by that. That just threw me right off.
Really? Okay.
Put me back on the clue bus, because I don't know what you're saying.
So if you are to take, let's say, I don't know, like this book, let's say this book is like a solid piece of wood.
Yeah.
If you were to zoom in all the way to the atomic level of this book, it's mostly empty space between the atoms.
Okay.
So I know it sounds a little esoteric and a little out there. I'm also a little bit of a, you know, I like reading about quantum mechanics and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, it's that concept of the whole is not always what it seems. So sure, we're mostly bacterial DNA. We are mostly physical space in our body. So we also have to remember to honor these things. So when someone comes in and they go, oh, well, I have a mold issue, let's give them an antifungal. It's like, okay, well, what's happening with the microbiota? What's happening with even the energetics of the person, the being of the person? So we always need to take into consideration the different hidden parts of the whole. Does that make sense, what I'm getting at there?
Yeah, yeah, I do get it. And I know you have a little one, and I'm just wondering if you read quantum physics at night before bedtime.
Gosh,
mommy's going to talk to you about the outer core of certain mold spores.
So you laugh, but there is a great little children's book that's the ABCs of physics, and I think the B stands for black hole. And yes, so I'm a little bit of a nerd on that front too.
Oh my God, what you have to look forward to in your future. You know, I want to mention that you're the vice president of the ICEAI, and I said that we were going to tell people what that is. So
right.
That is the, drum roll please,
International Society of Environmentally Acquired Illness. So we are a nonprofit, and our goal is to educate physicians about how to handle people who are sick from their environment. And of course, with our environment, we're also considering chronic infections, and because that comes from your environment too. We had our initial conference in May of last year, and we had amazing names like Lawrence Afrin and Horowitz and, you know, Neil Nathan and Kelly McCann and all these really great people coming to talk. And we have an upcoming conference in October of 2020 that we're really excited about. And the lineup is starting to just look phenomenal too. So
where is that going to be?
That one's going to be in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Oh, I love Scottsdale.
Yes.
So that's next year, October 2020.
October 2020, and I believe it's the 10th through the 13th.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. You know, I think Dr. Kelly McCann is an awesome resource as well. She did a podcast with me quite a while ago, and it was it was someone else that sent me to her, but she's just as lovely. So
yeah,
we'll have to have a spa of tea or something together.
Mm-hmm. And Kelly's on the board. Kelly's on the board of ICI too. And in fact, Kelly is just an amazing physician. She's an amazing lecturer. She is an absolute powerhouse. And she's like an integral part of us planning our 2020 conference. So if this gets back to Kelly, thank you for everything that you do for us.
Well, I'll try to remember, or when I send you the link, you can forward it to her and just say, look who I know. And she's like, oh, it's Cindy Kennedy. That's so cool. So, you know, before we end here, I really have to say, people, there are some of my patients who have followed me through this journey. I didn't share with them for a long time that I was not well. And then when I started the podcast, I said, you know, here's where you can find me, you know, if you want to listen, whatever. So I do have people that listen that are well.
Mm-hmm.
How do we stay well? How do these mm-hmm. people, you know, what kind of tips, what kind of little cues can you talk to people about in terms of trying to, you know, keep themselves healthy?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And that's going to ebb and flow. You know, I think listening to yourself and listening to your reactions to your environment are really the first thing that you have to pay attention for. And beyond walking into a place and saying, oh, I got a headache, it's, you know, that Barbara, man, she really irks me and she's pushing my boundaries and I can't do it. And what I mean to say there is really understanding and taking care of yourself and listening to the signals that your body's giving you about any of the situations that you're being placed in. And so that's really the core. And then from that, you can really rise to meet those concerns that your body's like yelling at you. You know, it's okay, well, I walked in here and I got a little bit of a headache. Maybe I'll go home and take some charcoal and some glutathione and stretch and get a rest. You know, yeah. I think that self-care is going to look very different for everyone. And I know self-care for me looks, you know, a lot different from day to day.
Do you emphasize good nutrition?
I emphasize how many spoons people have. Are you familiar with the concept of spoons and spoonies? No?
No, but I did see a poster once that says spooning leads to forking.
Oh, no.
Yes, and please use condiments.
Oh, gosh.
Okay, that's different. Okay, so spooning.
Spoons. So there's a concept of invisible chronic illness, which Lyme falls into, EDS falls into, POTS falls into, you name it, mold toxicity falls into. And someone came up with the concept of this visual of you have so many spoons throughout the day, and each one of your tasks costs one spoon. And why it's a spoon, I don't know, but it works. And you have 13 spoons, so what are you going to give your energy to at the end of the day? And so if someone comes into me, and we lovingly call them spoonies, if someone comes into me and they just don't, I mean, they can't sit upright, I'm not going to touch their diet. You know, I mean, maybe ask them to eat a little bit more fat, or maybe ask them to throw in a little bit more greens, but I am not going to rehaul and shift their diet if I can't even, you know, if they're such in a state of fight or flight and they can't take care of themselves, you know? So, I mean, if I had my way, everyone would be GMO free, glyphosate free, completely organic, high fat, high fiber, moderate protein. That would be like my goal for everyone. But sometimes all you can do is get someone to eat a piece of bread because they just don't have it in them to prepare any food or do anything. And you get there, you eventually get there and you cross it off your list. But you know, it's really a matter of the bandwidth that you're starting with.
Yeah. People are not going to recover from mold illness overnight. It took a long time to get there probably. Right. And it's going to take a long time to recover, mm-hmm. but you see it, you've done this. I mean, you did start in this mold realm. You started in general primary care and mm-hmm. then became infatuated with mold.
Absolutely infatuated with mold. And you know, I see recovery every day. I call it graduations, and every now and then I'll announce them on my social media of like, hey, I had another graduation today of someone like, and I lovingly tell people, I was like, get the hell out of my practice. You're good. You're healthy. Oh my God, I never want to see you again, but I also love you and appreciate you. And I'm here, but I love getting people better and recovering them. And it totally is possible. I mean, even my practice, it's named Life After Mold for a reason. Like, sure, maybe it will be that 2 to 3 years in your life where it was a dark time and you didn't think you could get through it, and you just couldn't see the forest for the trees, but that is a chapter. You guys have so much more of your book to write after that.
That's so encouraging. Super, super encouraging. And while we were chatting here, I went in and started to follow you on Instagram. So
thank you.
You got one more follower.
Woo! Good. You'll have to harass me.
No, I'll try to be really kind. tell us again. We can find you at, give us your social media.
So every single social media outlet, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, it's all Life After Mold. And my website is also Life After Mold. And if you go onto my website, there's a couple of different ways you can get a hold of the e-booklet for the Mold Prevention 101. There is a pop-up when you first land, but if you do have a pop-up blocker, somewhere in the top menu, you'll see Mold Prevention 101, and you can go sign up for it, and it'll get delivered to your email.
That's great, because I just asked about staying healthy, and so there's probably a bunch of tips in there. So I will use it. I'd like to see what I can grab out of that and put to good use. You know, people like you that make reinventing the wheel not needed, because there are so many people that we can use as our mentors and being an advocate for so many people who are not well. So I thank you so much for being part of Living with Lyme series here. And, you know, you're in Waterbury, Vermont, and people need to find you. Those are all the ways that they can. Mm-hmm. And I encourage people to look Dr. Lauren up, because she's all that and the cat's meow.
And to make things easy for people, we do in-office medical appointments where people can be established. But if someone just kind of needs like general coaching and general directive, we do offer that by phone for folks too.
Yeah, that's really important. That's really important. Well, everybody, this has been Dr. Lauren Tessier, and she is just an amazing mold expert. And I want to encourage you all to come back, listen to our next podcast. We are getting close to number 100. Ooh. Can't believe it. Getting there. Please come to my website, www.livingwithlyme.us. Please subscribe so that you will not miss out on a new release. And I encourage you to come back and be really your own advocate, because if you won't do it, no one else will.
Right.
So, yeah, very important. All right. And this was a no whining zone, because Dr. Tessier has that behind her. All right. Everybody, make it a good day. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Living with Lyme. We'd like to take another moment to thank our sponsors. Botanical medicines are an important part of an integrative Lyme disease program. Biocidin from Biobotanical Research is a professional strength, broad spectrum formula that has been extensively researched for effectiveness as a nutritional support in Lyme and co-infections. University studies have shown that this combination of plant medicines is also effective on biofilms that may be hampering treatment, as well as providing broadly acting herbal support. The liposomal form of biocidin, called biocidin LSF, is used by Lyme-literate physicians such as Dr. Richard Horowitz and Dr. Jill Carnahan. Ask your practitioner about biocidin LSF and visit biocidin.com for more information. Master Supplements. Does living with Lyme ever get overwhelming and finding the right support seem difficult? Well, Master Supplements can help. Master Supplements specializes in probiotics, enzymes, and fiber that help support digestive and immune health during and after antibiotics. Master Supplements products provide results that you can feel working, with a 60-day money-back guarantee. Their staff is available to help you decide which products and programs are right for you. Master Supplements is dedicated to science-based products with the highest standards of quality control. Visit master-supplements.com for more information, or call and talk to a team member at 800-926-2961. That's master-supplements.com or 800-926-2961. Thanks so much again for listening to Living with Lyme. We'd like to remind you that if you have not done so already, please subscribe to the podcast. You can visit our website at livingwithlyme.us, so you make sure you don't miss any episodes. Until next time, thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back soon with a new episode.